it's, I think, one of the things that we're really noticing in the world today is that we really need to listen deeply to Aboriginal and First Nations voices to really learn how to look after our land and live with it, and make sure that we have something for the generations to come.
Welcome to the Everyday Changemakers podcast. I'm your host, Dave McManus. On the podcast, I interview everyday changemakers to learn more about their story, how they began, and what challenges that they had along the way. With this podcast, I hope to inspire other people to take action on the things that they're passionate about to make the world a healthier, safer, and more inclusive place. Rebecca, welcome to Everyday Changemakers podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Rebecca, could you kick us off and just tell us a little bit about yourself? Where are you from and what's your background?
I've grown up in Victoria, in country Victoria, and studied university in Melbourne. When my husband and I had a small family, we decided to move to the Northern Territory in 2002, just to learn a little bit more about the country that we live in and the culture. And I'm a teacher and a property valuer, and I've also been a journalist.
And when you moved up to Northern Territory, whereabouts were you located, and could you tell us a little bit more about that town?
Yeah, we moved to Wadare, which is southwest of Darwin, about 500k southwest of Darwin. It's about a 5-hour drive. It's probably one of the largest remote communities, with a population of about 3,000 people. In the wet season, the road gets cut off by water, and you can only fly in and out from about December to about April.
Amazing. And you were a teacher up there, is that right?
When I first went there, I wasn't a teacher. My husband, Justin, was a teacher. My background before that was a property valuer, and there wasn't really much work for a property valuer in a remote Aboriginal community. So I had young children at that stage, and I worked part-time at the school. Actually, I had a really great job there working in the language production centre there, where they have a bilingual language program. So the school in Wadare learns both the language from the area, which is Murinputha, and in English as well.
So you started a social enterprise called Cafe Dumu. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, and why did you start it, and how did you start it?
We started Dumu Cafe as a result of really looking for opportunities for young Aboriginal people that we're involved with to get some skills to prepare for work readiness. We'd been working with young Aboriginal people who had come from the Northern Territory down to Victoria. And while some of them were at school and others were completing TAFE courses, we just weren't finding a pathway to them for employment. They didn't have an opportunity to be able to really learn how to work and what that actually entailed. So even basic things such as getting to work on time, making sure that you've had breakfast, making sure that you've got clean clothes on, that you have enough clothes to wear, and those sort of things. So just really basic work readiness skills to begin with, and then coming all the way through to, we've had people who are being able to manage a cafe by themselves as well.
That's amazing. And the employees who are working in the cafe, they're coming directly from Northern Territory?
We partner with Tamura Youth Indigenous Corporation, which is a locally owned and controlled youth organisation from Wadare, and they decide which participants will come down to be part of the program. They travel from Wadare to Darwin to Melbourne, and then 3.5 hours to Bright in Victoria. So it's quite a journey for them. Generally, they come here for 3 months at a time just to see how they go. And they can stay on if they prefer, or as part of our program, we look for other opportunities if they return back to the community. We have a multiple entry, sort of multiple exit strategy, where sometimes it's not right for them at the first time that they come, they can go back to community and then decide to come at a later time as well. So it's trying to make entry into the workforce as gentle and supported, but still giving them realistic work and life skill experiences.
That's amazing. Could you tell us a little bit about the difference in the culture between, or for the listeners who don't know much about Aboriginal history, could you tell us a little bit more about their culture?
Sure. So Wadair became a mission in 1935. And at that stage, seven different language groups were all brought together in the mission. So often it was groups that didn't generally engage with each other. So some of those sort of tribes were warring tribes as well. It started off with different groups coming in and living in the community at different times until all of the groups came and lived there at the same time. Most of the people in Wadair, English is their second or third language. So if they come from the Wadair area, they speak Murrinputha. So most people who live on that land speak Murrinputha, and others will also speak the language from where their actual land is. So most of the participants who come down here, English is their second language or third language. Working in the predominantly English speaking world is very different for them. Numeracy is also something that has a completely different language as well. So in terms of working a cash register, cooking food, working out numbers and multiplication and that type of thing is totally different for them as well. So it's just a totally different culture to come to the mountains in Victoria from the floodplains and the sea of the Northern Territory.
And Rebecca, could you tell us a little bit more about why it's important for them to have these opportunities?
So at least 90% of the young people there are unemployed and really have nothing to do. There's no opportunities for young people to access any skills-based training, and they really don't have control really of their own futures at all. By the time they're about 14 or 15, they're not many of that age group actually go to school. And you can imagine that when you're totally disengaged, there's a lot of social problems such as alcohol abuse, marijuana, fighting, domestic violence, and a lot of jealousy as well. So there's a lot of just nothing for these young people to do, which then causes a lot of problems for them.
Your program helps them build up leadership skills, working in a team. How important is that for them and taking that back to the community?
It's an interesting one. The most success we've had is when we've been working with the young people to design the programs that they need. Often in Australia, we tend to think that we have the answers to the problems of other people. So what we do is we just try and work on skills that they have identified themselves that they want to learn, and give them lots of different opportunities to see what is out in the world itself rather than just in the small world that they live in. We haven't always been successful. A lot of the time when our participants go back to community, it's hard then to be able to fit back into that same lifestyle as well. So, or to be able to take those skills and actually do something with them in the community. There's, just talking to some of the young people recently, they find that when they do go back to the community, there's a lot of jealousy from other young people. And it's really hard to be able to develop those skills. So what they see though is that the more and more young people who do get these opportunities, then that will generally change things over time as well. So they know that this isn't a short-term solution. It's going to be a longer-term solution to these problems, but they think that if we continue these programs and more people do get to have these opportunities, then it will change.
And could you tell me a little bit, how did you first get started? Something like this sounds incredibly hard to put together, and you mentioned you made a few mistakes. How did you first get started?
I think sometimes you get started on these things because you don't realize how big it is. So you think, oh, surely I can just give that a try. And we did. And we were lucky enough that we found a building that was an old backpackers building, and we were able to convert it fairly easily to a cafe. We didn't have girls really in the program until we started up this training cafe as well. The building that we lease is also an old backpackers building, so we have accommodation and those sort of things for the girls that come down here as well. So we have boys and girls that both do the training here. And yeah, we've changed a lot over the course of how we do things. And I think that we've still got quite a few changes that we need to make before we can get it right.
Yeah, it sounds, just basing on what I'm reading about the reviews of the cafe, it sounds like people within the community are really enjoying it. Could you tell us a little bit more about what this has had an impact on the Bright community and even tourists coming in? What is it from their perspective? How is it received?
Yeah, it is funny when you start out with something like this, you have a goal in mind about what you want to achieve, and it's the things that you achieve along the way that probably have more impact. And I think that the impact that these young people from Northern Territory have had on the Bright community or tourists that come here has probably been just as significant as the impact that's been for the young people as well. We've decided that we really want to go down that track a little bit more. So we try and use native food ingredients in all of our products, just so that we can be really promoting the richness of our Aboriginal culture in Australia. We also try and make sure that we engage and get our products from Aboriginal-owned businesses and keep that supply chain as sort of pure as we can. We have also focused on making some products that we are going to be selling as well. We make some little bliss balls with native foods and some salsa and dukkah and some beautiful cordial as well. So just really trying to promote that, yeah, just the value that Australians need, that we should all be proud of our Aboriginal heritage here in Australia. And so we get a lot of groups that come in, and our participants then, yeah, really get a chance to show their leadership qualities, speaking to large groups of people and sharing their culture.
That's amazing. I'm so interested in learning more about the Aboriginal culture, and this seems like such a great way to experience it in some way and just learn more. That's awesome.
It's for me, I think that you start off doing these things, you think that you start doing these things because you're doing it for someone else, but realistically, what I've learned from all of this and just the richness that it's brought to my life I feel like I'm really the luckiest person alive sometimes, just to be able to engage with these beautiful young people who you can just learn so much from.
Absolutely. And the Aboriginal people, could you tell us a little bit more about the history of the Aboriginal people for those who aren't from Australia? Like, how long have the Aboriginal people been around for, and, you know, just some of the types of, you know, the foods and the way that they were so innovative with their way of life?
Sure. So Aboriginal people have evidence of Aboriginal people in Australia for at least 60,000 years, and there are at least 270 different languages, only 20 of which are probably strong languages. So Murrumpatha, the language where the people from Wadair come from, is still considered a strong language and a first language. There's only about, as I said, about probably 18 of those in Australia at the moment. But there's a lot of Aboriginal language groups are starting to revive languages, which I'm lucky enough to be involved in here in Bright as well, with the local language group from around this area. And that's one of the things it's really important for Aboriginal people to really be respectful of being on country that sort of has different custodians to their country. So we encourage a lot of interaction between the traditional owners from the area here in Bright, where we have our cafe, and we engage with them in sort of everything that we do. Actually, Dumu, the word Dumu means black duck in the local Dharawal language from around Wright, and totally different from the word Lhotpa, which means black duck, from Murrumpatha. So you can see that it's many different cultures within Australia. And it's, I think, one of the things that we're really noticing in the world today is that we really need to listen deeply to Aboriginal and First Nations voices to really learn how to look after our land and live with it and make sure that we have something for the generations to come.
Absolutely, and that's such an important message. I want to kind of go back to just a point you mentioned before about allowing these communities to build and guide the program themselves rather than you coming in and trying to force a program on there. Could you tell us a little bit more about why that's important and what you see in the future?
I think First Nations Australians have had a way of life imposed on them for the 230 plus years that European people have been living in Australia. And there's been a lot of programs over the years, over these, 200 so years, that have been implemented on Aboriginal people. And self-determination is something that's been sort of bandied around for quite a few years, but a lot of people don't really allow it to fully present itself. And I think that's really the only way of moving forward. So that's what we are for the community, I think, and with the community, but I never feel like I'm the one making the decisions. So when we're working together, we can better achieve those outcomes. So I think that there's still a place for me, but I'm hoping that one day there won't be.
Yeah, that's a great mentality to have. And what are some of the things that I guess need to happen to help provide opportunities for Aboriginal people in Australia?
I think in Australia we have a policy that's been going for the last 10 years or so called Closing the Gap. And the gaps are in education, in healthcare, in life expectancy, those types of things, which the closing of the gap, though, when identified by Aboriginal people, is the gaps in non-Aboriginal people understanding about culture and the importance of land and the importance of language and those sort of things as well. So I think that it's really, there's a gap between the gaps itself. And I think that's one of the things that we really need to start doing is looking at what is the gap that we really need to close, and that those gaps need to come from both sides as well. So closing a gap doesn't just start from one way and moving, it's about coming together. And it's a concept that people have referred to as reconciliation in Australia. A lot of First Nations people don't really believe that it should be a reconciliation. They're not sure that there was ever a reconciliation, so there needs to be a little bit more than that probably as well. So I think that moving forward is that we really need to listen and do a lot more listening and a lot less talking.
And I guess what advice would you have to people who are listening who want to get involved and learn more about Aboriginal culture or support or get involved in some way would be your advice to them?
I think a little bit of what I was saying, it is really about taking those opportunities and realizing, thinking about why you want to be involved as well, and think about what sort of impact you want it to have on your own life. And then it's an easier way to actually value what you'll be learning rather than just thinking that you'll be the one doing the giving, that you're actually be getting probably more than what you're actually giving as well. So it's about really looking at partnerships and walking down that road together. Also, I think it's hard for a lot of Australians to actually understand the difficulties that are faced by a lot of remote Aboriginal communities. And I think that I hadn't really talked about a lot of those things as well. But when things are out of sight, they're often out of mind. And a lot of our remote communities have overcrowding in houses, really poor access to health. There's a lot of domestic violence, but that all stems from a lot of these sort of really core issues. A lot of people who don't live on their own country, so they don't have that autonomy that they need as well. So there's a lot of issues there, and I think that there's a lot that we don't actually understand. So it's really not making those assumptions, but yeah, really it's about that deep listening and be ready to hear a truth that Australia might not want to hear as well.
What are some of the businesses, Aboriginal businesses that you mentioned before, and what role do you think that plays in building prosperity within the community?
Yeah, there's a great initiative called Supply Nation, which has a lot of Aboriginal businesses that are registered there and makes it easy for large business or governments to be able to make sure that they include Aboriginal goods and services in their procurement. There's, in terms of native foods, they're starting to get possibly a peak body and some Aboriginal organisations that can trying to actually control the IP of their own bush foods, which is, I think, really important as well. And we just try and use Aboriginal businesses as many as we can. I'm working with some great young people who have actually been through our program at the moment, who are working to set up their own media production company that really is going to be pitched to young Aboriginal people such as themselves as well. So really making sure that everyone gets access to messages and those sort of things that they haven't before. And I think that's one of the things that's been really throughout this period of COVID-19 is that we've just realised that media itself doesn't actually always reach everyone that we need to. And I think that this is something that they've highlighted as well, that they can actually, it's worked out that this is a niche that they need to go down, and actually there's clients there that wouldn't be able to get messages about viruses and other pandemics and those sort of things, so that there is a need for different types of these organisations.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think mentioning about the IP, I think that is so important for the bush foods.
Yeah. It's a little bit like the languages as well, in that a lot of Aboriginal groups want control over their own languages. They want to be speaking their languages and not having other people control that. And it's the same with the bush foods as well, that everything else has been taken away from them. It's not fair that just because Aboriginal foods have become popular, then they shouldn't be precluded from the custodianship of those foods as well.
And I mean, from an economic perspective, it is also would provide a lot of opportunities as well within the communities if they were to receive the money, if they were to do social enterprise with it as well.
So we're talking about products such as saltbush, which is grown on a lot of the dry land in Australia, and there's lots and lots of different types of saltbush. Up in the mountain areas here, growing wild is mountain pepperberry, and you can use the leaf as well as the berry. We've got a native thyme that grows around this area. In Moree, they have the Kakadu plum, which is or Mimaral, which is in their language, and that is super high in vitamin C and antioxidants and known as a superfood. There's lemon myrtle, which is prolific. We use cinnamon myrtle and anise myrtle, bush tomato, native lemongrass. There's just so many different products, but it's really important to make sure that they are protected and grown in the way that they're supposed to be grown.
I can't wait to eventually get back to Australia and get come out to the Duma Cafe
and have a
Yeah, oh wow, that's amazing. That's great, Rebecca. Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. It's really exciting about the work that you're doing and the work that a lot of other people are doing to help provide more opportunities for our Indigenous. So I think that's awesome.
And I'd recommend for anyone to read Bruce Pascoe's Dark Emu to really get a picture of agriculture and foods and farming in Australia.
Rebecca, any final comment to our listeners?
So in 10 years, I'd love to see a lot of our young people have gone on to either employment or further education or started their own businesses, and just be able to have that confidence that they can actually walk in two worlds. They don't need to lose their own culture. They need to be, they should be proud of that, but they can actually walk confidently in both worlds.
Rebecca, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks.
Well, that's another episode of Everyday Changemakers. Thank you so much for tuning in. It means a lot. If you can hit the subscribe button on the podcast player of your choice, that would be greatly appreciated. And head on over to dgmgrowth.com/everyday-changemakers to get the latest show notes. Thank you so much.